The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about using skulls for cups. Nowadays or in the past, Dave?
This is in the past, in the way, way past. This is about 15,000 years ago, although the practice of using skulls as cups actually still goes on today. There are people known as the Agori sect of India that still use skulls as containers. But that's not what this new study is about. This new study is about finding the first instance of humans using skulls as cups. And what we mean by that is taking a human head, scalping it, removing the ears, eyes, everything, pretty gruesome stuff, and then shaping that skull into a nice smooth structure that you can use as a cup or some other sort of container.
So where was this first evidence of using skulls as cups found?
Well, it was found in a place called Gose Cave, which is in Cheddar Gorge, Somerset in the UK. And this is a place where actually a lot of tourists flock every year. There's cliff tops and actually a lot of caves in the region. And apparently it's also famous for its local cheese. But what the scientists were concerned most about here was a cave, this Gose Cave, where they had already found a few years ago these prehistoric human bones, and they had dated these bones to about 15,000 years ago. And in the new study, they report on a few of the skulls that they found here, and these skulls showed evidence that they had been crafted to be used as cups.
Are skulls a good container for holding liquids, Dave?
Well, you wouldn't think so. And actually, they probably aren't, because the sutures, if we want to get gory here, the sutures in the skull would actually probably leak liquids. And so the researchers are still trying to figure out why these ancient peoples would do that. We know that peoples that do it today, it's part of a symbolic ritual. And the authors suggest that something very similar was happening 15,000 years ago. This was a period of intense symbolic and artistic activity. So it's possible that these skulls were part of some sort of symbolic or even a religious ritual. Now, to get to your question of exactly what they put in it, again, liquids probably wasn't the most practical thing to put it in. And in fact, one of the experts suggests that they may have been used to serve human brains.
So some kind of cannibalism going on then.
Exactly. And there is evidence to suggest that a lot of these ancient people actually, when they would conquer an enemy, would cannibalize that enemy. And so one way to make that cannibalism even more symbolic and ritualistic would be to carve that enemy's head into a container, serve the enemy's brains in that container, and then everybody gets to feast on the brains.
Cheers, Dave. Cheers. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, why don't we stay on the topic of brains, but this time talk about what brains are used for rather than being eaten. This next story is about early emotional development in rhesus macaques and how it may provide clues to autism in humans.
Early emotional development, babies bonding with mothers, what?
Exactly. Actually, in the first week of a baby macaque's life, it spends a lot of time looking directly at its mother. And this is actually a pretty unusual thing in macaque society, because when macaques get older, actually staring at each other is a form of aggression. But when macaques are very young, staring at their mother is what the researchers think is a way they're trying to mimic their mother and start to develop both socially and emotionally. And you can actually see a very cute video of a baby macaque imitating its mother's lip smacking on the site. But what the researchers notice is that's the normal behavior. But in this study, they separated some of these baby macaques from their mothers before this mimicking started to happen. And these macaques were fed for a little while by humans and then reintroduced to macaque society. And what happened with these reintroduced macaques is that they quickly started lagging behind other macaques that had grown up with their mothers in the ability to reach out and grab objects. They didn't play as much. They exhibited a lot of behaviors that we associate with autism in people.
Is there a parallel developmental pattern in people then, as with macaques, looking at their mothers the first week?
Well, Rob, it could be that autistic children don't imitate their mothers as infants, and that may be an early warning sign of autism. Right now, there's still a lot about autism we don't know, especially when it develops and what some of the first signs of it are. So if this macaque study translates into humans, it could give doctors an early sense of when a child was displaying autistic behaviors and potentially lead to earlier interventions. But that research question just hasn't been investigated yet.
I'm just wondering, in terms of separating babies from their mother in most U.S. hospitals to be put in nurseries, how long was it that the baby macaques were separated from their mothers before those separated would later exhibit these autistic-like tendencies?
And that's an interesting question, Robin. Researchers don't know the answer to that. What they do know is that even by day three, these macaque infants were starting to mimic their mothers, which suggests that this is a behavior that starts very early on, at least in macaques. Remains to be seen how well any of this is going to translate to humans.
Does it have to be the mother?
Well, Rob, when they tried to have humans sort of take the place of the mothers, the baby macaques didn't imitate the humans, which suggests that this is something that's very species-specific. The macaques don't just try to imitate anybody, but it remains to be seen whether a surrogate mother would be able to bond with an infant in the same way.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, this last story has to do with an idea known as the hygiene hypothesis. And basically this idea is that people that are more exposed to parasites and other contaminants are less likely to have allergies and asthma because something about our biology that protects us from pathogens also may make us hypersensitive to allergens. And the hypothesis came along because researchers noticed that in developing countries where people are exposed to a lot of diseases and parasites and whatnot, these people tend to have a much lower incidence of asthma and other allergies than people in the developed world. And this new study is all about trying to figure out exactly why that might be the case. Is there some sort of biological mechanism that explains that?
So it's not as if it's some inherited difference. It's really just the exposure of the child to the environment.
Well, that's what the researchers are trying to figure out. Is this something genetic? Is it something that just appears during somebody's lifetime? This new study indicates that it at least appears to be partly genetic. What the researchers did in this new study is they traveled to a region known as Conde, which is a cluster of rural fishing villages on the coast of Brazil. And there's a parasitic worm called Schistosoma masoni, if I'm saying that correctly, that is very common in this region. About 85% of residents are exposed to it. And previous studies had shown that the individuals that produce the most antibodies against these worms are also the most resistant to worm infection. And the resistance is about 30% heritable. And researchers also noticed that when they administered a medication to get rid of these worms, the incidence of asthma and other allergies shot up. So they were seeing this connection between the ability to fight off a worm infection and an increased risk of allergies. And the hypothesis that the researchers had was that there might be mutations that help individuals fend off these worms, and maybe by really boosting our immune system. But the problem is if your immune system is really boosted a lot, it becomes hypersensitive to everything. And so if you have an allergen, it may react much more strongly to that than somebody who has an immune system that's maybe not as jacked up. And so to firm up the connection, the team collected blood and stool samples from about 850 people in Conde. They tested their blood for antibodies. They looked for a lot of different things. And what they found was a lot of similarities between genetic markers that were associated with resistance to worm infections and markers that are associated with asthma.
So you said there was this genetic component, and then there's this hygiene hypothesis. Is it one or the other, or both, or what's going on?
Well, chances are it's a pretty complicated picture. What's interesting about this study is they're showing some heritability here, which is important both for allergies and for dealing with parasites and other contaminants. And they're still trying to suss out the exact mechanism for how something like the hygiene hypothesis could work. But this study really takes them a lot closer than they were before.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about what a child cremation site reveals about domestic life in Paleo-Indian Alaska, and also a story about how wolves follow gazes. It may seem something that's very easy, but it's actually something that very few animals can do, and what that means about the development of higher cognitive abilities in some animals. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the aftermath of the Egyptian Revolution and what that means for science in the country, and also continuing coverage of the new U.S. budget, or at least the proposed budget from President Obama, specifically some stories about what the impact could be on climate change legislation and green energy for the future. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.